Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and I'm joined, as always, from Tallahassee by Gannett State Capitol reporter John Kennedy. Hey, John.
Hi, Zach.
And Palm Beach Post politics editor Antonio Finns is also with us today. Hey, Antonio.
Hello, gentlemen. Good to be here.
Well, protests have erupted in cities across Florida to voice outrage over the death of another unarmed black man. And while the demonstrations have mostly been peaceful in recent days, some have resulted in property destruction. Meanwhile, Governor Ron DeSantis is moving forward with phase two of his reopening plan, even as the state is still falling short on coronavirus testing. And Florida GOP leaders are hoping to host the Republican National Convention in the state after North Carolina's governor rejected a full convention. We'll talk about all of that and more, but first, it's number picking time. Antonio, you want to go first?
I'm going to go with an even 100.
All right, 100. How about you, John?
Zach, I am edging pretty close to Antonio, but my number this week is 97.
97 here. All right, and I'm going to slide in under both of you with a 3. So that's 100 for Antonio, 97 for John, and 3 for me. Remember those numbers, folks. Write them down. We'll tell you what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. Well, the coronavirus crisis has quickly been eclipsed in recent days by protests that have roiled cities across the nation after a white police officer in Minneapolis killed a black man named George Floyd kneeling on his neck during an arrest for nearly 9 minutes. Many of the protests have been peaceful, but the reaction to Floyd's death also has been marked by looting and property destruction in many cities, including across Florida. A Champs sports store went up in flames in Tampa. Police cars were burned in Miami, and a police officer was slashed in the neck in Jacksonville. There even was looting in smaller cities such as Sarasota and up in Tallahassee. A protest near the state capitol was disrupted when a truck drove into the crowd, a scary moment that thankfully resulted in no injuries. Governor Ron DeSantis stayed quiet about the protest for days before finally coming out with a statement late Monday. DeSantis first condemned the looting before expressing concerns about Floyd's death. He said, quote, "Florida has zero tolerance for violence, rioting, and looting. George Floyd's murder was appalling, and the Minnesota perpetrators need to be brought to justice, but this cannot be used as a pretext for violence in our Florida communities." While there was some isolated looting over the weekend, that appears to have dissipated, and DeSantis noted in a later statement that the protests here in Florida have largely been peaceful. Antonio, what do you make of the governor's response to this so far?
He's trying to straddle a really tough situation. I mean, clearly by any means, any way you look at this, what happened to George Floyd was horrific. It was murder. I mean, there's no other way to say it. And there has to be justice. At the same time, this question of protests, and there is a clear difference between a protest and rioting and looting. I mean, there's no question about that. Here in South Florida, that distinction is sharp. And it was actually 40 years ago, just last week, that Miami was the scene of the rioting, serious rioting and mayhem after the four police officers were acquitted in a beating of an unarmed African-American motorist who was stopped for a traffic stop, beaten to death. The four officers were tried. They were actually tried in Tampa, acquitted, and we had almost a week of rioting and looting. And ultimately, the political ramification was that the then president, Jimmy Carter, lost Florida in the 1980 election to Ronald Reagan. And part of it was the idea of just this, 1960s law and order approach to things. So this is a really touchy situation because on one end, clearly what happened to George Floyd, just like what happened to Arthur McDuffie 40 years ago, was just terrible, horrific, and appalling. And the expression of that anger was quite justified. But when that expression of the anger turns violent, as it did, and the reality is, as reporters, we got to state the facts that there was some looting. There was some, I covered the Arthur McDuffie riots as a stringer at the beginning. I was still in high school at the time. So, I mean, what I saw in Arthur McDuffie was nothing compared to what we saw in, you know, what we saw with the George Floyd unrest was nothing, should I say, compared to what we saw with Arthur McDuffie. That was just two totally different things. But I think for a lot of people, institutional memory of 40 years ago, you know, so I think for the governor, this is a very difficult situation where you're trying to balance the needs of the population to express their anger over and justifiably express their anger over the horrific action that took place in Minneapolis, at the same time balance public safety. It's not an easy job.
John, DeSantis during the campaign was accused of being racist. He famously said right off the bat that we don't want people monkeying around, and that was interpreted as you know, Andrew Gillum, his opponent, was African American, and a lot of people saw racist overtones to using the term monkeying around, and that overshadowed a lot of his campaign. And so it's interesting to me. I mean, for him to come out with this statement, his first statement, and to really emphasize zero tolerance for violence, rioting, and looting at the top of his statement, and then mention George Floyd. Any thoughts on that? I mean, for somebody who has had issues about racial sensitivity, do you think that he got off on the right foot? I mean, and he was silent about this for days before he finally came out with a statement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think DeSantis's credibility with Black voters and progressives is not very strong at all. Yeah, that's an understatement. And many of these people are marching in the streets right now, calling for change. I think the governor probably sees the George Floyd case and its aftermath as, you know, not really his fight. So he's just going to keep his head down and talk about whatever gains are being made in the battle with coronavirus. We sort of saw this this week where he kept a very low profile for the first couple of days in the wake of the George Floyd, the death and then the demonstrations that followed. He wasn't holding his usual daily briefings on the coronavirus, which seemed to be an attempt to avoid having to respond to reporter questions about the death and also the demands for systematic changes to our racial divisions or Florida's own disturbing history of police and minority interactions. And again, you know, for the governor, like so many things we've seen him in, he is trying to navigate the space between what he thinks President Trump wants and what he believes Floridians want. In this case, DeSantis, you know, he thanked those who he called peaceful demonstrators, who made their feelings known, but also distanced themselves from those that were looking to gin up violence. But he said nothing about any possible excesses in the response coming from law enforcement, which seems to fit into the Trump playbook. And the governor, remember, you know, just the other day said he was sending 500 Florida National Guard troops to Washington, D.C. to help protect the White House, which has become the focus of so many demonstrations this week. So, you know, there's DeSantis trying to very carefully find a middle ground in this fight, it seems like.
What either of you gentlemen could address this, but what do you make of these protests so far? I mean, in terms of their political ramifications, in terms of how they fit into the larger political environment. I mean, all of us have covered a lot of demonstrations over the years on all different types of topics, you know, and I think back to covering Tea Party protests in 2009 and 2010, thousands of people out on the streets. Covering the Women's March after Trump was elected, thousands of people out on the streets. Here locally in Sarasota, I've been covering the protests the last couple of days. We haven't seen as many people, you know, a few hundred, but it's interesting to see the types of people who are out. It's more people of color, more people who are younger. I mean, this region isn't very diverse region, and it's not a very young region, but you're seeing a lot of young people on the streets, a lot of people of color coming out. And it's interesting, too, to see the sustained nature of these protests, whereas a lot of protests are sort of a one-off event or an occasional event. We're seeing sustained protests for many days here. I was out yesterday. They were even marching in pretty heavy rain. I mean, they put on rain gear and umbrellas, and they didn't let that dampen the protest at all. They marched through downtown Sarasota. I've never seen the streets closed and people basically marching through the streets and the police officers closing down the streets so that the people could march peacefully through the middle of Main Street in Sarasota. What do you make of all this? I mean, it seems like a really uncertain time. The police, at least here and in many communities, don't seem like they don't want to act too harshly and maybe be accused of aggressive tactics here. And just any thoughts on the dynamic with these protests compared to what we've seen in the past?
Well, I can tell you, I came across one yesterday in Davie, Florida, and it was exactly what you just said, Zach. A lot of young people, and it reminded me of the protest right after the Parkland, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting. The number of young people out there speaking up and voicing their viewpoint and participating in large numbers. You know, the really weird thing about this one, too, is that, you know, it comes in the context of a pandemic. And, you know, that people are suffering on so many levels. You have another, you know, huge number of people have filed for unemployment this week. We still have businesses struggling to reopen. We don't even know how many of these reopening businesses will survive. So it comes in this context of just, you know, real suffering across the board. So, yeah, I mean, it's and you wonder, maybe that's what's sustaining some of it.
And it does seem like this is relentless right now, that there's no end to this. The protesters are calling for real changes to be enacted, and businesses and governments and any kind of community organization seems to be acknowledging things that they had failed to acknowledge for many years. You're seeing that with law enforcement to a certain degree too. But at this flashpoint where the demonstrations are still going on and still alive, it's something that it's hard to see where these internal changes, whether it be, you know, more diversity training among staff, whether it be an aggressive reach out to minority communities for employment, whether it's something where there's more interaction between white and black Americans, just how we're going to see it all play out in coming months and coming years. Because it does seem like that's the ultimate demand, is to have more equity and more fairness. And here, you know, we've gone through, as Antonio points out, we're in the middle of the pandemic, which has really had more impact in its own way on minority communities than it has on predominantly white communities. There are more deaths, there are more essential workers that are minorities, it seems, and they're on the front lines of this pandemic. And when it comes to unemployment, they're getting hit harder than the white community as well.
Sure. And to a point that Antonio made about this, in some ways echoing Marjorie Stoneman Douglas in terms of young people participating in the system and getting out and being motivated, I wonder if that affects the election. If young people are more politically engaged, more politically aware, and people of color are engaging here on the issue, I mean, it does seem like that could be a wild card as we go into election season, that could affect potentially voter turnout. It could also affect voter turnout if older Americans, think that there's too much unrest and that they want, if some of this turmoil continues, I mean, that could create a backlash that could help Trump too. So we'll see. It's probably too early to really say how this affects things politically, but it's definitely an amazing dynamic right now, and a lot of uncertainty surrounding it in terms of the politics. Well, while he grapples with the unrest stemming from George Floyd's death, DeSantis continues to move forward with his plan to reopen the state after being on lockdown for a month to limit the spread of the coronavirus. Bars can reopen at 50% capacity, and retail shops will now be allowed to operate at 100% capacity. John, the governor is plowing ahead with reopening, even as testing still lags in the state. Is that a smart move?
Yeah, the governor has been all about pushing the state toward reopening, and he is convinced, at least himself, that the state's volume of testing, that its shrinking rate of positive cases as well, which is hovering around 5% or less of those tested, that clears the way for more public interaction. And so
shrinking rate, though, but yesterday the largest number of new positive tests in like more than a month, right?
Yeah, that was remarkable. That should be the day that he announces that we're moving into phase two, that we saw the biggest spike in cases in 6 weeks. But you know, we're at a point now where bars will now open at least partially, movie theaters, bowling alleys, arcades and tattoo parlors, tanning salons, they can open too if they follow health department guidelines for social distancing and sanitizing. Retail stores can now open at full capacity, and so can gyms. So DeSantis has been moving pretty swiftly at increasing these levels that, you know, just started unwrapping in recent weeks. And now he's helped that the NBA is announcing that it's going to finish its season in playoffs in Orlando. So he's also going to be pushing for more celebrity golf tournaments too, WWE and other made-for-TV sports events. He's opened the door to Florida for those to come here if they want to do these events that are, you know, largely without any kind of fans, but they're going to be television content right now. But testing is still not where epidemiologists say the state should be. I wrote a story this week looking at how Florida's average, it's 29,952 daily tests conducted the past 2 weeks, that still falls short of what these public health experts say is the level that the state should reach based on its population. And that level is about 31,800 tests per day. So we're about 2,000 daily tests off what they should be to try to contain this virus appropriately. Contact tracing, where, you know, anyone who has been associated with someone who tests positive for the virus, and they can be tracked and told to isolate, that hardly exists at all in any sophisticated scale in Florida. At least that's what the experts view it. And DeSantis announced that the next phase of reopening, before he did that, he went through a detailed presentation of how there are plenty of hospital beds available in Florida. The positive rate is declining. There have been no deaths of anyone under age 18 from the virus, and that 85% of all COVID-19 deaths in Florida involve people age 65 and older. So he's kind of rolling the dice that all this new interaction in the marketplace or the bowling alley and the tattoo parlor, that it won't lead to a spike in coronavirus cases, just as we thought things were easing off. And with universities and K-12 schools now also looking to return to campus in less than 2 months, and enacting a host of new health and safety protocols, you know, a lot of people are hoping that DeSantis proves right in this case.
Antonio, what do you think in terms of how the governor is playing this? Because I know you've said in the past that you think he is sort of reading the mood of the state, right? That people are sort of ready to get out. They've been cooped up for a long time. They want to see things reopen. But if you reopen and you don't really have the measures in place to test and to understand where how quickly the virus might be spreading, and to contain the virus and to trace the contacts and isolate people so that they're not, you know, infecting other people, you really do risk, you know, a second wave here that might force you to roll back what you've done. And that would upset people as well. Any thoughts?
Yeah, but that what they're rolling the dice on, like John said, is that they can the hospital capacity in this state, that the healthcare system can absorb a spike. My number a few weeks ago was 30%, which I explained was the averaging of the availability of the hospital beds in Florida. Today it's 27%. So they're rolling the dice that they can absorb a spike. And part of what this speaks to be honest, is just the abject disaster and debacle that has been the Florida unemployment benefit system. Part of the reason you have just sheer desperate people in Florida today is because people closed their businesses. They laid off their workers. They made the economic sacrifices that the state asked them to. But when it came to get assistance, the measly $275 a week, the money didn't arrive. It didn't arrive even on a timely basis. And then when the federal money started coming in, we have a story that we just posted this morning that even though some folks have gotten the $275 from the state, they haven't gotten the $600 from the federal government. That's why you have this desperation. So the governor is basically, you know, I think that the issue is that people, if you want me to shut down my business and you're not going to give me assistance in an economy, a Florida economy that is small business dependent, people are going to reopen up. They got to get back to work. And I think they've decided, you know what, as it is, you know, if there is a spike, we'll deal with it. We'll try to absorb it as best we can in the hospitals. But I mean, I'm driving around and I'm seeing people open up. And in, by the way, in parts of Florida, there are people walking around without masks and barely social distancing. So this could very well backfire and backfire really badly. But I think that they're looking at the moment and they're making a decision that, like John said, roll the dice.
And to your point about unemployment, Antonio, DeSantis has really emphasized that the problems with unemployment are because of this faulty computer system, got overwhelmed, and that this was done before he was in office. It was interesting to see this week, Politico Florida was out with a story that said during his transition, DeSantis was warned about this, that he was specifically warned about how the unemployment system was not in good shape, and that it presented some serious problems and needed to be fixed. So the idea that he doesn't bear any responsibility to this isn't borne out in some of those early warnings. Was part of his reopening plan, DeSantis has been eager to get theme parks operating again, despite concerns about transmitting coronavirus in big crowds. And he's also trying to attract another crowded event to the state, the Republican National Convention. DeSantis is laying down the welcome mat for President Donald Trump to bring the RNC to Florida. Talk about moving the convention out of North Carolina heated up this week when the governor of North Carolina rejected the idea of holding a full-blown convention, something that Trump wants. The easiest place to put on the event in Florida would be Jacksonville because it's run by a Republican mayor who is a former state party chair, but the city lacks the necessary facilities, particularly hotel rooms. John, it's still not clear how much of a real possibility this is, but it says something that Florida leaders are eager to bring this event here despite safety concerns. Do you think this could backfire if we see new coronavirus cases in the wake of the convention?
Well, we've been to these conventions and they bring giant swarms of people. 50,000 were expected to be in Charlotte for the Republican convention, which would be August 24th to 27th. It's a tremendous challenge to have any kind of protocols involving temperature taking of delegates, sanitizing bars, hotel rooms, shuttle buses, the guys that sell souvenir buttons, t-shirts, and this, of course, being a Republican convention, you're going to see swag that demonizes Joe Biden and Barack Obama. But presumably, Florida public health officials would be at the forefront of this health and safety measures somehow. You'd need a tremendous staffing capability, it would seem. And they've been struggling just to keep up with demand in this big state for field testing and the care of Floridians. And now these public health care workers are going to have to be watching over that conventioneer from Ogden, Utah, or Moorhead, Minnesota, who has arrived to, you know, apparently celebrate a second nomination for Donald Trump. You know, it's funny. In 2012, Florida hosted the Republican National Convention in Tampa, and its start had to be delayed a day because of the threat of a tropical storm that was churning in the Gulf. Well, a breakout of coronavirus, that could be even more devastating for the party and also for the governor who opens its doors to the to the convention. You know, what one side note, the Florida Republican Party chairman during that storm tossed 2012 national convention was Lenny Curry, now the mayor of Jacksonville, whose city is, you know, as you pointed out, Zach, considered maybe the front runner for getting the convention if the event really does exit Charlotte.
Antonio, you've covered a lot of conventions over the years. I mean, it's considered a big boon to get the convention in your state. It brings attention. It shows that your state is important in presidential politics. It's a networking event for political people. It's also a big economic event. But in a time of coronavirus, I mean, there could be a lot of negative publicity attached to it too. When you have this massive event, and who knows? I mean, the virus, you could be having this convention at a time when infections are surging. DeSantis, he's an ally of Trump. He seems to want to please the president. But what do you think about the risks associated with having a convention here?
Yeah, I mean, that's the key thing is that by the time that this convention is to convene on August 24th, which, by the way, is also the anniversary of Hurricane Andrew back in 1992, to John's point about what happened in 2012. But by the time this convention convenes, we may well be in some sort of a spike, or there may be a surge in cases. Who knows? But I do think that from the political, and I think John is or addressed a lot of the issues here, but I think from the political side, I think one of the attractiveness to this, to the Trump 2020 campaign, is that a convention here could help lock up the state. We've seen polls where Trump is now trailing Biden in Florida, which is now Trump's stated home state. In addition to that, it's one of the states where, up until the pandemic, his numbers in terms of approval ratings were better than most other states, that he has been extraordinarily popular among Republicans here, that we've seen that in polls show that Republicans in Florida are much more enthusiastic about voting for Trump than Democrats seem to be about voting for Biden. So, it's a state where, you know, showing now that, you know, that Trump is trailing Biden here, we've seen enough polls that suggest that there is accuracy there. That this might be an opportunity to shore up Florida, allowing him then to spend this arsenal of money in other places. So from, if we're looking at it from a just purely, put aside coronavirus, just a political play, Florida makes really perfect sense, even more so than, for example, Las Vegas and Nevada, which is another place that they could supposedly is vying to host the convention. But again, there is the backdrop of coronavirus, and what does this look like by the time you get to early August? And, you know, by then, you know, Disney is opening up in mid-July. Universal has opened up. By the time that you get to August, much of the Florida economy is opened up. So we will know whether there's a spike or not. And it's a risky play, but this is what Trump has said. The reason he's pulling it out of North Carolina is because he wants a full-blown convention. And anything other than a full-blown convention is, I think, for in the way that he sees it, a defeat.
Well, we'll see. I spoke to Florida GOP Chair Joe Gruters last week about this, and you know, he thinks it's a real possibility, and he's been actively trying to make the arrangements. So, it's still not clear what's going on here and whether they're really going to pull out of North Carolina. And if they do, how that would look. I mean, there's been talk about even splitting up the convention with different events in different states. So who knows what's going to happen. But it definitely seems like Florida is in play here if they do move some or all of the convention. Well, let's do some numbers here. We'll go from highest to lowest. Antonio, you had 100.
100 refers to a West Palm Beach resident named Gladys Schaefer, who a couple weeks ago turned 100. You know, that's a landmark birthday. To get to the century mark is a landmark birthday that is generally celebrated, you know, very robustly. I mean, think of it. You made it to 100. And Gladys celebrated her 100th birthday, but not with her family, certainly not with her daughter or her grandchildren, nobody, because Gladys is in a long-term care facility in West Palm Beach. And of course, they are on lockdown. And there's a lot of talk, and we've spent a lot of time on the podcast talking about Florida opening up and bars and so forth. What is not opening up is visitation to long-term care facilities across the state. They're still going to be on lockdown at least until July 6th, maybe even longer if you do see a spike in cases. And, you know, that's one of the hardships. And, you know, you've written a lot about it, and John has, you know, what's happened in nursing homes and fatalities and so forth. But even in places, long-term care facilities that have not had tragedies, there's still a fair amount of suffering in that these individuals are on lockdown. They're not able to see their family members. Many of them suffer from dementia, and not being able to see family members means that they lose contact and they forget about them. And that's been kind of like the hidden under the surface, the cost of the pandemic and the lockdowns is that, you know, those last years of golden years that some of these individuals are going to have, they're spending it in isolation, and they're spending it away from their loved ones. And it's one of the hidden tragedies and the hidden suffering of this pandemic. And as you get closer and closer to election season, you know, the fact that so many of our residents remain in lockdown, remain isolated, remain suffering, this is also going to play out. And, you know, and this is also how people are going to view the way that the DeSantis administration has handled the, you know, the coronavirus pandemic, and particularly caring for and protecting senior citizens, and the cost that, that those protections have had, as well as the cost of the economic shutdown. So to Gladys Schaefer, happy 100th to everybody out there in these in our long-term care facilities that are hitting milestones and celebrating them away from their family. They're not forgotten.
Happy 100th to Gladys. And you're right, Antonio, it's an absolute tragedy that people aren't able to see their loved ones in what could be the final weeks or months of their lives. And, you know, one thing that could help that would be better testing. I mean, a lot of this does come back to things like better testing. If you were able to test a visitors and get the results quickly, you'd have some comfort with them going into the nursing home, that they were not going to transmit coronavirus in that nursing home. So if you had a quick turnaround test, you know, that could solve some of these issues. So the difficulty in getting widespread and good testing plays into that. John, your number is 97.
Yeah, and Zach, 97 is 97%, and that's what the tourist tax in Orange County fell by in the month of April, when the Orlando area, home of Disney World, Universal Studios, SeaWorld, even the Holy Land experience, were among the things that were shut down by the coronavirus. Tourist taxes, sometimes called the bed tax, so that counties charge on rentals, often but not exclusively hotel rooms, it raised almost $26 million in Orange County last April, kind of a normal year. But this April, tax collections were less than $1 million, just under $766,000. The tourist tax collections in Orange County are usually rivaled only by Las Vegas collections nationwide, and the Orlando area tax collections, they account for 30% of these tourist taxes that are brought in by the entire state of Florida. And they locally, they help support the county's convention center, sports marketing, some of the entertainment venues like Dr. Phillips Performing Arts Center and Camping World Stadium. But it really is just one more visible sign of how dependent this state is on visitors. And when they stay away, so does the money. We've talked about how the state took in took a hit of almost $900 million in its revenue in its April report, which mostly reflected March's collections. But what happened in Orange County is likely to be reflected on a statewide level when the next round of tax collection reports comes out later this month in Tallahassee. So these are stunning numbers, and it certainly shows that the state is struggling when it comes to financing state and local governments for the months ahead. There's just no tax collections, and that's what fuels the everything we know as services coming from government.
Yeah, definitely going to be some really difficult budget discussions going forward here if there's not some kind of federal assistance package. Well, my number is 3, as in Cristobal became the third named storm of the Atlantic hurricane season this week. Never since record keeping began in the mid-1800s have there been 3 named storms so early in the hurricane season, which officially began June 1st. And that is not a good sign considering all the other problems we're dealing with right now. Cristobal doesn't appear like it will make landfall in Florida at this point. Maybe the far western end of the panhandle is a little bit in play here, but it seems like it's probably going to avoid the state. But there's still a lot of uncertainty in the forecast track. If the storm were to threaten Florida, it would present really an unprecedented challenge for Governor Ron DeSantis. Pretty much every governor deals with some kind of emergency. In Florida, many of them have their leadership skills tested by hurricanes, but no governor in modern times has dealt with so many calamities all at once, from the racial justice protests happening right now to the coronavirus and the deep economic troubles we're experiencing. Throw in a major hurricane and Florida's emergency response mechanisms would certainly be pushed to the breaking point. Let's hope it doesn't happen. That wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team of Thomas Cordy and Joseph Frazzano. And thanks to all of you for listening. Stay safe. We're out of here.